On this week's 51%, there is no soap involved in forest bathing.
You're literally like, you know, letting yourself be absorbed in the forest atmosphere.
An artist shares her experiments with encrypted woven storytelling and find out why a certain state has the highest number of children being raised by people other than their parents. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. First, we bring you a story from Wyoming Public Media storytelling podcast, Human Nature. In the piece, we hear from a woman who went from full speed ahead to a full stop. And then she found a place that showed her stillness is okay. After college, Andrea Cerubi Foresta started a career in public relations.
It was a fast-paced industry. And at the time, I remember getting a BlackBerry and just being submerged in this 24/7 news cycle, which we're all a part of now. But in my job in particular, you know, I was sort of in a world where we were constantly being contacted and having the technology that allowed us to be in constant communication.
Andrea was living a fast-paced city life that was defined by her career. But she'd always known that she wanted to be a mom, too. So after a few years, she and her husband started a family. And everything changed.
My mom was a stay-at-home mom, and that was always sort of my conception of how I would do motherhood, was that I wanted to, if I was able and if I had the resources and the support, to stay home with my children when they were small. And there's no way I could have ever prepared myself for what it was actually like. You know, people say it's like going from 0 to 60. In this case, it was like going from 60 to a full stop in the middle of the road. And it was something that I didn't know really how to navigate because, you know, I'm used to dealing with a lot of tasks throughout the day and being very social with other adults and responding to email and posting on social media or writing something or being up on the news and having this kind of period of time that I had control over. And then once I had my first son, suddenly, you know, you're at the whim of a baby. You know, in any kind of job, you're getting feedback. You have a performance review, you get a promotion, or you at least they're told, hey, you did a great job on this project. When you're really kind of in the weeds of like young children raising, you're not really getting that so much. You know, there's kind of like a stereotype, especially when you're full-time at home, like, well, what did you do all day? It's hard to talk about. Well, I did a lot of laundry and dishes and I played with the baby and we went for a walk and whatever, but it's very amorphous. It's hard to kind of really kind of quantify that. So that was a challenge to kind of go to this space where I was like, well, who am I? You know, am I my job title? Am I defined by where I work or what I do?
And then more changes. Andrea's husband took a job in New Jersey. For her, this brought to mind images of construction and congestion, not exactly a peaceful place for a young family.
I remember thinking like, oh no, we're moving to New Jersey. But my husband was like, no, trust me, you're gonna love it. I'm not gonna bring you someplace that's like too, you know, congested or crazy in terms of traffic and whatever. So when we moved here, I did not know one single person in this area where I live here, which is central New Jersey. And then I had this little baby and I was staying home. So, you know, I remember just kind of grasping for things that were familiar to me. And that always led me to nature. And I remember seeing around my house at the time, like trail entries, you know, little wooded trailways. And they were like beckoning to me. It was as if they were calling, like saying, come explore, come see what's down here. And so I would often take my son exploring, like, let's just see where this trail goes. And sometimes there would be a map. And sometimes we just kind of followed our instincts, and we'd often end up at a creek, and he loved just sort of skipping stones and throwing rocks. And I have vivid memories of being in these spaces with him and just being at peace.
Andrea had two more boys, and she kept taking them to the woods. The more time she spent with them in the woods, the more the woods started to change for her.
There was this one trail across the street from my house, and that would lead me down to the main trailhead, which kind of opened into like a small little meadow, and then there was a creek. So sometimes I would just take the boys down there to play at the creek, but if I, you know, just was alone with the baby, you know, then I would cross the creek, and that to me was like crossing this threshold. Like, I'm now leaving the real world behind, and I'm stepping like through the wardrobe into Narnia. This is this magical forest that I'm going to spend some time in. And as I've reflected on how did this happen, like, why was that different for me than all the other times I had been in nature? And I do think that the fact that it was me and my little, you know, nonverbal baby, or me by myself, really gave me an opportunity to be super, super present in nature and observe what was going on around me. Really tuning in with my senses and just letting nature kind of wash over me and just be 100% immersed in the moment. And that was really where I had, you know, very profound experiences in nature. Everything from, you know, walking in the woods and just noticing trees don't, you know, they don't judge based on like, you're too fat, you're too skinny, you're too tall, you're too short, you have no leaves, you have too many leaves. They just don't care. They just exist in harmony together. That was something that stood out. It was like kind of no judgment. You don't walk into the woods with a title. You know, you don't walk into the woods with a promotion. You're not going to get a promotion from the trees. You're not necessarily going to get a raise from the trees. It's like a great equalizer. And the other profound thing for me was the cycles, the cyclical nature of nature. And I think that really, really stood out when I just push forward all the time, thinking, go, go, go. Like, you do more if I read more, if I, you know, study more, if I work more, if I'm more connected, if I'm constantly connected, if I'm going all day long, I'll somehow achieve something. But that's not true in nature ever. And watching the seasons unfold, watching day and night, watching, you know, the cycle of the year kind of take place was just this great reminder that nature has deep periods of rest and what appears to be death in the wintertime before life blooms again in the spring and summer, and then, you know, this letting go. And I just felt there was this wisdom inherent in where I was walking, like that there was more there than just plants and trees. But I do remember feeling many, many times that I wanted to share what was in the woods and sort of just wanting to shout, like, everybody come see this. This is incredible. This is like so gorgeous. This is so beautiful. There's so much meaning here. And I feel like we've taken that for granted. Like, even I have done that, you know. I've been caught up in my busy life and have driven past beautiful trees, driven past beautiful woods and not given them second thought or not spent intentional time in nature. But then after having that opportunity and feeling what it could do, that's when I felt like Everybody should know about this.
Andrea had been going to the woods for a while, practicing mindfulness amongst the trees. Then she discovered she wasn't alone.
And I remember seeing an article pop up about this new wellness trend. And I remember reading about it and saying, what, forest bathing? I was like, that sounds exactly like what I'm doing. And thinking like, does this involve soap or a washcloth? Like, are you taking a bath in the forest? No, you're literally like, you know, letting yourself be absorbed in the forest atmosphere. And they've done tons of scientific research that indicates there are actual proven benefits in terms of reducing stress hormones, increasing immunity, fighting agents in the body from being in the forest.
So Andrea wrote a guest blog post about what she was experiencing.
About the trees in winter. The trees are bare, they're spindly and stark, and, you know, they just look like they don't have any life going on in them. But rather than feeling sort of bleak about it, to then turn that around and say, well, actually, it's a period of deep renewal and restoration. And there's a cycle here of renewal that is preparing, you know, the earth for the coming spring. So this time is actually something that we can embrace instead of fight against. I sort of just shared it among my own network. And people were, you know, like, oh, that's cool. That sounds great. But I didn't hear much. I didn't really expect it to turn into anything else. But then 2 months later, I had a message on through my Twitter account from an editor asking me if I'd be interested in talking to them about writing a book on forest bathing. And I was just, you know, surprised and shocked and a little skeptical. But once I talked to her, I was like, okay, this is real. And sure, let's see where it goes.
What was it like to write the book, especially since you didn't consider yourself an expert?
Exactly. I mean, and I remember saying that to the editor. I said, well, listen, like, let's be clear. I'm not an arborist. I'm not, you know, I don't have an ecology background or forestry background. But, you know, I said, I have been practicing meditation and yoga for a decade now. And, you know, really believe in these mindfulness techniques and have this passion for nature. And I happen to have a journalism degree and worked for about 15 years as a writer. So that area was covered. Once we'd workshopped the idea of the book and decided that it would be this miscellany style where we would be able to include around 200 entries of a variety of information, that was something that I was just so excited about, because what I felt like I was experiencing personally in the woods was sort of a sacred experience. And the book gave us an opportunity to explore other people around the world who have had sacred experiences, specifically with trees. And we were able to include a bunch of, you know, excerpts of ceremonies, traditions, practices, holidays, celebrations, everything.
Why do you think humans experience trees as sacred?
I think it's sort of a two-part answer. You know, their stature is one thing. They're so much taller than we are. And there's so much symbolism in, I think, the structure of a tree. A lot of cultures have a story of a tree of life because trees' roots reach down into the earth, then their branches reach up to the sky. So many legends and lore about heaven and earth involve trees as a link in the same way. In terms of the structure, they remain rooted to the ground and steady. They're this just great symbol of strength and resilience. And there's a lot of traditions that sort of revere them for those reasons. I think also, you know, depending on the tree that's in your ecology, your local environment. For example, when I was living in DC, you know, there's a huge national cherry blossom festival. Cherry blossoms bloom for like 1.5 weeks each year. And it's this sign of spring, like spring is here. These beautiful pink, you know, cotton candy, effervescent blooms explode on these trees, you know, just for a week. It's very symbolic. It's very symbolic of the evanescence of life, how it's there for a moment and then we're, you know, we're moving on to the next. So I think the fact that many trees go through this cycle of death, the beginnings of life, it's very visual, an explosion of leaves that then burst forth, last through the summer, and then very colorfully sometimes drop in the fall. And then even trees like evergreens, like the holly, for example, or the tradition of the Christmas tree. I mean, that's one that we all, you know, many people are familiar with. People have looked at them and said, oh, okay, you're green all winter. You're a symbol of life, symbol of eternal life. Let's bring this inside and decorate it and celebrate this. And we know that even on the darkest days of winter, life still persists.
That was Andrea Cerubi Foresta on the podcast Human Nature. She was speaking with Human Nature's Caroline Ballard. Her book is In the Company of Trees. Minneapolis artist Heather McKenzie practices hand weaving and experiments with encrypted woven storytelling. She regards woven textiles as sensual while simultaneously embedding them with complex mathematical information. KFAI's Dixie Trichel produced this audio portrait.
Frames are all attached to cords that go to the top of the loom, which is called the castle. And then the cords come down.
My name is Heather McKenzie, and I am a visual artist who works in handwoven textiles. I was drawn to weaving because of how systematic and how mathematical it is. It becomes algorithmic pretty quickly, even in the most basic sense. A kitchen towel is some kind of algorithmic process. Even as a teenager, I wasn't thinking about that consciously, but I was also really into math. I like working really teeny tiny. I made a whole series of things last summer that were just 3.5 inches square. I also like working huge. So the biggest piece I've made is 22 feet long by 10 feet tall.
That sparkly stuff did come over, and that was under tension, and everything went through a series of these little holes. And then you can see some of them when I press on a treadle. Some things go up, some things go down, and those...
I have a love for natural fibers and really like wool and silk, which are protein fibers. Those are my favorite in terms of what I want to handle. Right now, I'm obsessed with this holographic curling ribbon that I made a piece for my upcoming show out of. It is called Queer Encrypted Weavings. I'm soliciting encrypted stories from queer, trans, non-binary, female people who want to have more visibility. And then they're answering a short survey that is a little bit more autobiographical. So I'm able to take the encrypted text that they have sent to me and embed that into these works as well in a pretty specific way. So it's, if you had the code, you could go back and decrypt it if you wanted to. It doesn't look like language, but it ends up becoming a larger pattern in the piece.
The warp would wrap around from that back beam all the way to the front and around. And then you would end up kind of cranking it onto the loom and tightening it.
I mean, one thing that I do love about weaving is that you can get into it from a lot of different avenues. So it can be an interest in math. It can be an interest in, you like to touch soft yarn. It can be an interest in color. My work has tended to be more tied to math and science and impersonal themes. Like a lot of artists working right now, part of it has to do with feeling like what I was doing wasn't saying enough. It has a lot to do with getting more comfortable with my own self, feeling like I can put that self out into the world, supporting this community that I belong to.
That was Minneapolis artist Heather McKenzie. About 100,000 Kentucky children are being raised by people other than their parents, a number that puts Kentucky above all other states. And a great number of grandparents are raising these children. A large number of these cases are because of issues stemming from the opioid epidemic, incarceration, abuse, or neglect. SideFX Public Media's Lisa Gillespie reports that this can put a grandparent in a difficult situation in a state where many people live in poverty and have big health issues.
Getting to Ann Polston's house is a journey. First, you have to get to Liberty, a town about 2 hours southeast of Louisville. Then there's a winding 8-mile road that's largely one lane and sometimes just gravel. At the end is Polston's 3-bedroom home, crammed with toys and VHS tapes and beaten-up furniture. Polston is raising 4 children, ages 2, 4, 8, and 16. But she's 51 years old, and their grandmother.
The 2 older ones call us Grandma and Papa, and the 2 babies say Mom and Dad.
The kids were born to Polston's stepdaughter, but when drug problems hit the parents, Polston and her husband got custody rights.
You know, as the saying goes, grandparents can spoil them and send them home. Well, we don't have that option unless we want to put them in foster home, and that's not an option for us. We don't want it.
But watching over 4 kids is taking a toll.
We're not spring chickens anymore. We can't keep running after them all the time, so it wears.
There's mixed research on how raising kids affects a grandparent, says Bert Hayslip, a University of North Texas professor. On one hand, grandparents might work longer and make decisions on the fly, improving cognition. But there's also a big downside.
Many grandparents seem to put their own needs behind those of the grandchildren. This includes medical and, for that matter, emotional needs in many cases.
Dr. John Fulton sees the impact at an outpatient mental health center at a local hospital.
They usually come in with complaints of either depression or stress/anxiety. They come in, some of them feeling guilty because they're aggravated at having to do this.
There are other problems, too. Polston has 2 slipped discs in her back from working at the post office. Back at her house, Polston picks up 2-year-old Sissy to change her pull-up.
Ouch! Ouch! Killing my back, kid.
In 2017, 63,000 children were in the care of grandparents in Kentucky. That's 6% of all kids in the state. And it's clear the opioid epidemic plays an outsized role. In a nationwide survey, that was the reason cited by 70% of grandparents who were raising grandkids. To help out, Polston and her friend Clydene Campbell formed the Alternative Parents Action Council. It's a support group that also teaches caregivers about available state benefits.
When social services gives you these children, they don't explain to you how to get the benefits or what you have to do.
Campbell is 58 and raising 4 of her sister's grandchildren.
And I mean, I love the children, but it's really hard at my age. I tell everybody all the time, I don't remember being a mother of being this hard.
The state offers limited resources, like some money and daycare assistance, unless grandparents go through a rigorous foster parent process. But the state hasn't always told grandparents about the help that is available. Now the state is starting to reach out more. But Terry Brooks from Kentucky Youth Advocates says that's not enough.
The state needs to make a much stronger and more consistent commitment to providing those supports like training and like respite care than currently is being done.
Like training and how trauma can influence a kid's behavior. And respite care, basically a babysitter, so people like Caldwell can take a break.
My big vacation for this year was spending a weekend in Harrodsburg, so... So, you know, I got away from the kids for 2 days, but still, I got to rest for a couple days.
For now, Polston and Campbell hope members of their group can babysit for each other so these grandparents can rest up before going back to nonstop parenting. For SideFX Public Media, I'm Lisa Gillespie in Louisville.
Now, a jazz moment. In 1969, pianist Joanne Burkeen lived in a six-floor walk-up in New York's East Village. At the time, not the safest place to be with young kids, but for a jazz lover, it was a magical location. The famous club, Slugs, was right around the corner.
Tiny club with sawdust, a beer for a dollar, and they had all the major people came there. One night, I said, oh, I'm going to go around and hear Art Blakey. The band sounded great, but then the piano player was up there not playing, just sitting. And it sounded like they needed a piano in the group right at that moment. So I went up to the piano and asked him, was it okay if I played? And he said, yeah. So I played, and I played the rest of the set. And then Art Blakey, he looked up and saw it was me, and he hired me on the spot.
Joanne Burkeen was the only woman to ever be a jazz messenger. This Jazz Moment with NEA Jazz Master Joanne Burkeen was produced by the National Endowment for the Arts.
Joanne Burkeen learned to play the piano in 6 months at age 11 by transcribing 8 Frankie Carl solos. By age 12, she was performing professionally. Burkeen is a full-time professor at Berklee College of Music in Boston. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1560.